Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode focused on B-17s. If you're in Southern California this weekend, you can catch the B-17 Sentimental Journey flying above the Plains of Fame Air Museum in Chino. One of the more memorable B-17 connections for me through the years came when I finally got to interview a heroic bombardier whose pilot had bragged to me about him a decade earlier. Let's hear first from that B-17 pilot, Bill McLeod, who experienced quite a bit while flying with the 303rd Bomb Group.
But what amazed me was the accuracy of the anti-aircraft. As we came in, we could see the anti-aircraft exploding ahead of us, and it was right at our altitude. They would be getting closer and closer, and finally they were in the formation. And that's where my bombardier got the Purple Heart, because some slivers of steel exploded and came into the nose of the airplane. And by the way, bombardiers were more casualties than any other position on the airplane. Anyway, he got hit with exploding plexiglass, which got into his eyes and his head. He wouldn't leave his position. He stayed there until it was time for bombs away. And we told him when to drop the bombs, and he flipped the switch. And then we took him back to the radio room where he received first aid. But we could hear the flak hitting the airplane. It was like gravel, throwing a handful of gravel at the plane. Fortunately, we just had one Purple Heart, and that was the only Purple Heart in all of my missions that I flew. He wouldn't evacuate. We tried to get him to leave, but he wouldn't. By the way, his name was Duke O'Donnell, and he was from Joliet, Illinois. I very, very much admired Duke for that, and I put him in for a medal after we got down. And then it was turned down. And later on in life, I got him the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Well, let's hear now from that blinded bombardier, Duke O'Donnell, and his memories of December 31st, 1944, from start to finish.
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target. I started seeing flak. They had three types of ways to shoot flak: straight at the plane, or what they call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four-gun batteries or six-gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer. And I knew they had at least four, and I knew the next we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone. The top of my head was gone. I just sat there waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. So anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. So he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day. Maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, Mac says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought to myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter. They can get back to England easier if I lighten the load up a little bit. You see how I was out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off. It was a chest pack, so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room. But I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute, huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing. We thought there were no brakes. Mac did, the pilot. So we landed, and then they did finally have some brakes, so we were okay there. And then the ambulance came, take me to the hospital, and they'd say, like, was it a rough mission? And I'd try to make the right answer, but something like, it's going to rain next Tuesday or something. would come out, you know. So I went to the hospital, and I think the next day I was okay. Of course, maybe, like I say, I don't know. So I stayed there a week in the hospital and then came back. And I flew a couple of missions, and then they trained me as a GH navigator, which was it was a new invention by an Englishman. You would have two radio signals, sending stations, about 100 miles apart right behind our lines, and each would send out a signal. The plane would fly along one signal, and when it got to the other one, that was the target, so you dropped the bombs then.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it, but people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was, all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. No, couldn't see. But, the plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right. That's about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs. And this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out what, like I say, I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. They were quite, there's still one in my nose, but doesn't bother me any, and so I don't know how many they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind. And you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this, what they call a toggle switch, and got them out that way.
You know, and Bill had never told me this part, because maybe he didn't know what was inside your head. He just told me about, you know, he wanted you to get a Distinguished Flying Cross for that. You did receive the Purple Heart. But this whole thing about when they're taking you back to get medical attention, that you thought about jumping out of the plane. You really thought your extra weight was going to cost the crew?
Well, as I say, I was kind of out of my head. And I was thinking, if I jump out, it'll make it easier for them to get back to England. So I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but the engineer, as I say, took my parachute off, the chest back parachute off me, and so I couldn't jump. I did have enough sense not to jump without a parachute, that's all. So, yeah. So I did get back to the radio room there.
But you were moments away, perhaps, from doing that, and I know you had 7 children, and now you have 6 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, so I know they're all thankful you didn't jump out there. But you're still blind and wounded. You know the plane's in trouble because you've been shot up. So what was the rest of that mission like for you until they got you to the ground?
Well, we were back in the radio room. I don't recall too much about it. We flew back, and then we got in a sitting position. When you're going to make a crash landing, we thought there were no brakes, so we had to make a crash landing. And the pilot and the co-pilot and the, I think, the engineer were the only ones that could were doing their job. The rest of us all were sitting up against the wall in the radio room in case the plane, you know, we were backs to the wall of the radio room facing the front. And then I'd sit here and then somebody sit next to in front of me and then somebody in front of him. We'd make it as easy as we could if we crashed. I mean,
you're pretty much bracing for impact, and What's going on in your head? Are you clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer?
No, it didn't bother me a bit because, as I say, I was really out of it. You know? Uh-huh. So, no, what's new? So we made crash landing.
So they get you down. You're treated in the hospital. At what point were you able to see again? And was there some time where you thought, hey, I don't know if I'll ever see again?
Well, I never thought about not seeing again, but as I recall, well, they took me to the hospital, and when they took the glass out, I could see. It was, I think it was quite sore, but I was able to see then, yeah.
That has to be a pretty good feeling, that maybe you appreciate your sight a little more after you've lost it for a while.
Yeah, of course, that was the same day, so I wasn't, I didn't know what I was doing. Next day, I appreciated it, yeah.
I know I'm bouncing around a little bit here. But again, you're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, the first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought it's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most, and I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
And it almost sounds like you were resigned to that fact. Was that a patriotic thing? Was that something from your faith? Or what do you think enabled you to keep doing what you were doing, knowing that there was a good chance you wouldn't come back?
Well, I think you're trained to do it. You feel it's your obligation to do it. Your friends are doing it. You do it too.
After you survive all that, you said you, it was only a few weeks before you were back in the air again?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, back flying.
Was that hard? Were you? I mean, after you go through something like that.
I tell you, the first mission after I got hit, I was scared stiff, I tell you. About every 30 minutes, the bombardier takes an oxygen check because we were had oxygen masks on. So I remember saying when the flak started, I tried to say over the intercom, oxygen check, nothing came out. I was so scared.
You couldn't utter a sound.
No, but that was what we called a milk run, a real easy mission. No fighters and not too much flak. But the next one, that had been the next mission I flew, I don't know what would happen, because the briefing officer before the mission said there were 350 flak guns down there. They had, as I say, several ways of firing it, but one was box flak, they called. And they put everything they had up in the sky in the same place at the same time. And 350 artillery shells going off at the same place in the sky at the same time is quite a spectacle. And that happened in front of us the next mission. And if that had been the one previous.
And what did happen there? Because it sounds like maybe an analogy would be you're going through a cheese grater or a paper shredder.
Yeah. We had a lot of damage that time to the ship, I know.
And when you're about to fly through it, and you're the guy in the front of the plane in that nose, do you close your eyes this time? Do you duck your head? What do you do?
No, you can't close your eyes or duck your head. You have to watch out for enemy fighters and watch out for the target, and you know, beyond your best there, yeah. And the guy's been good to me, as you can tell.
Well, and he has been good to you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when I go back to New Year's Eve in 1944, I get the feeling that you think he was there with you.
Well, he must have been. Yeah, I go along with that, agree with you.
That was Duke O'Donnell. And I know this reputation of World War II veterans is so humble that they downplay their heroics. It's almost become a cliche. But doesn't Duke's attitude reinforce what I would say is a genuine pattern? That's been my experience. And when we come back, another story in that vein from a wounded airman who was awarded the Silver Star for what he did after being shot up by a German jet. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.